Big news! This episode is sponsored by Smart Travel, a new podcast from NerdWallet. From choosing the right travel card to dodging hidden fees, Smart Travel helps your money go further, literally. They cover all things travel finance, like which flight deals are actually deals and which are clickbait. They'll also tell you when to skip the bundle and book separately. Plus, how to avoid paying for upgrades that you won't use. Travel smarter and spend less with help from NerdWallet. Follow Smart Travel wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a Voyascape podcast. You can find all of our travel podcasts from around the world at voyascape.com.
And welcome to the Fromer Travel Show. I'm your host, Pauline Fromer. Every nation has either an identity or the reputation of an identity, perhaps no more so than the French. And the French are known for many things. They're known for being very sexy. They're known for their wine and their cuisine. They're known for their protests and marches. But they're also known for how they enjoy life in a very specific way. And my guest today, Kathy Yandell, who has written a delicious book. It is called The French Art of Living Well, Finding Joie de Vivre in the Everyday World. Welcome to the Fromer Travel Show, Kathy.
Thank you so much.
So I think joie de vivre is very purposefully used in your title. Tell us a little bit of the meaning of joie de vivre and why it is such a French term.
Well, I think it's wonderful that joie de vivre now appears in the Webster's Dictionary. Why? Because we can't figure out another way to say it.
In English,
because joie de vivre literally obviously means the joy of living, but it incarnates so many other things in French tradition, as you know. And I found that really fascinating as a point of departure. It really wasn't known until Balzac used it in the 19th century, but it's almost ironic in his sense. If you ever want to read his novel by the same title, I don't recommend it if you're looking for joie de vivre.
but he has a novel called Joie de Vivre.
He does. Yes.
Can I ask very quickly what it's about?
Oh, it's very sad. It's about, it's tragic. And, you know, there's a murder involving trying to get rid of one of the spouses so that other two people can get together, and about the whole world around them falling apart after that, in a nutshell.
Wow. So the book looks at different ways that the French find joy in everyday life. And you illustrate that with a lot of personal anecdotes, with history, with entomology of words. I mean, the book is such a wonderful, I guess I feel very French, so I would say it's a wonderful salad of all of these different elements that come in. My father was a devoted Francophile. And what he loved about France was that he felt it was a country that took the life of the mind very seriously, and that intellectualism was something that was celebrated and part of daily life. And you have a whole section of the book about the life of the mind, public intellectuals. What does that mean in France today?
Right. Well, that's such a nice question, because I think reading is a very important, and historically, and even today, is a very important part of French culture. So there's a primetime television show on new books coming out, and La Grande Librairie, it's called, the big bookstore. And it invites authors of recently published books, and sort of everybody gets together and watches this. And when you're waiting at the bookstop, you see ads for books. And I talk about public intellectuals because a lot of the French very well-known intellectuals and writers do readings, public readings, sometimes in gardens, sometimes in bookstores. And I just feel very privileged to have met you know, several authors that I normally would never have the occasion to meet in the U.S., but I think it's a commitment, even historically, for people to share what they've spent years learning and working on with the public.
You talk about that the French publish 60% more books per capita than is published in the U.S., which I thought that was remarkable. And you have a beautiful quote. Let me see if I can find it. You say, this is from Gustave Flaubert, and you say, do not read as children do to enjoy themselves, or as the ambitious do to educate themselves, wrote Gustave Flaubert. No, read to live. What a beautiful statement. And you also talk about one of the ways the French enjoy their lives is they have these long, deep conversations. They do this in a different way than we do. They're taught at a young age to engage in debates with one another. And nobody takes it personally if you pursue a thought or pursue an argument. Tell us a little bit about that and how you think that's different than how we talk to one another in the United States.
Well, I think it starts with children. And having lived in several French families myself, particularly one summer, because I used to lead groups for the Experiment in International Living. And that's a Vermont-based organization where students actually live in families abroad. And the group leader also lives in a family to be experimenting themselves. And so I found out very early that children are challenged in French families in ways that I think Americans, particularly today, we have a tendency to say to students and to children, oh, yes, what a very fine job. This is what I liked about it. This is beautiful. And my own daughter, who was in French schools, came home with the most beautiful Pegasus that she had drawn. Now, bear in mind that no one in our family has even an ounce of artistic talent. And this daughter came home with the beautiful picture that she had drawn with watercolors. And we said, how did this happen? And she said, well, because the teacher said, that doesn't look like a unicorn. That looks like a giraffe. This is awful. Start again. You can do it. So it's not simply tearing them down, but it's being really critical for a good reason. And the traditional school, a French school, is like that as well. And I think probably the best balance might be between the two countries, in that traditional French education might have been just a little on the stern side. But nonetheless, there is this expectation, not only that you do good work, but also that in the intellectual domain, you don't just have a thought and throw it out there. And then the parents say, oh, what a wonderful thought. No, the parents say, why did you think that? Well, what would you say about this? Are you sure? Because there's this other example. And so even small children have to defend themselves. And one example I give in the book is a parent who will say to your kid, well, how did you like the movie that you just saw? And the kid would say, oh, I thought it was wonderful. And the parent would say, well, I saw it and I thought it was pretty lousy. So what did you like about it? You know? And so the kid is taught to defend very early.
And I thought that was fascinating, because the idea of having conversations as long as the French do, I think I would, I mean, at one point you say that when you go to a French wedding, it never ends before 4 a.m. because everybody is eating so much and talking so much. And I can't imagine as an American speaking to people till 4 a.m. I think I would get exhausted.
Well, to be fair, the speaking and all that probably goes on till about midnight. And then there's the dancing too.
Ah, okay.
But yes, French meals are notoriously long because they're not just about eating. They're about discussing, as you say.
Yeah, yeah. I loved the fact that you also drew a bridge between this and the French proclivity to go on strike.
Yes.
So tell us how these two things link up. I thought this was brilliant.
Well, the thing is, if you stand up for yourself, if you're taught to stand up for yourself, then you see something that you don't like, then collectively you decide to make a statement about it, right? And to make a strong statement and to make a statement with thousands of people. And I do think that that comes from that early training of questioning, of saying, maybe I don't have to accept the status quo.
And you say that this actually, you think, gives the French more peace of mind because they have a feeling of being actors in this world. They can make change. They have it ingrained in themselves that if they stand up for themselves, there could be good outcomes, right?
Yes, I do believe that. You see that in French politics quite a lot.
Another great thing about being in France is there is art everywhere. And this was such a beautiful statistic. You say that after the pandemic, the French government invested, I think it was 300 million euros just in arts, which was the most by far of any nation on earth. What are the other ways that art is all around you in France?
Well, just, I don't know if you've seen much in the way of French advertising. Everyone listening who's been to Paris and even seen the billboards and so on, I mean, there's just such thought within advertising. But more importantly, there's in every city, and this is true to a certain extent in the United States, of course, but much, much more in France, where there's a museum on every corner, or there is a monument, or there is a sculpture. So it's, again, it's like public intellectuals in a way. There's public art everywhere. And as you just suggested, it's very much, there's a French word, subventionné, which is to subvention, you know, that is to underwrite artists. And that has been happening since roughly 1515, when Francis I became the Renaissance king. And the Renaissance is known for its artistic qualities. And there were musicians and painters brought to the French court. And that's just been a part of French government ever since.
The other thing you talk about in the book, well, you talk about so many things, but I went to Marseille a couple of years ago, and I was so stunned by all of the graffiti and the art on the walls. And you say that this exists in Paris, which is not something I've seen that much. So if people want to go see the street art in Paris, where do they go?
Well, great question. Probably the most amazing neighborhood. There are two really, really fine neighborhoods to do this. And what I would recommend is looking in guidebooks, because there are tours by French street artists themselves in both French and English. So if you speak French, definitely recommend that. But the two areas are in the 13th arrondissement, where there are just lots and lots of buildings who have artists from all over the world doing these wonderful murals. And the second is in Montmartre, up by Sacré-Cœur Cathedral. And they're big pieces, but they're also little tiny pieces, and they're redone. For example, an artist will have a particular stamp, sort of, and they won't sign it, but the stamp will tell you who it is. And there's this artist called Invader, or Invader as in Space Invader, and he actually has an app where people can find his murals and little... These are actually not murals. They're more like tiles. They're more like mosaics, I guess. Right. And they are all over the world. And there is a particular app for the phone that will help you locate them. And then people have contests to see how many they can find in the most unusual places, around corners, behind things. One particular artist, a female artist, does little breasts that she puts everywhere. And she makes blue breasts and yellow breasts and so on.
Painted or sculpture?
Little sculptures, but that go on the wall.
Wow.
And the idea is that they're behind ivy on a wall, so you have to know where to find them. So it's not just that the art is there, but it's sort of become this big, wonderful game for people to find street art by different artists.
Oh, that's great. I love it. You also talk about the different elements of joie de vivre, one of which is water. And I had never noticed that there are all of these fountains I've noticed that there are fountains in France, but that there's a particularly large amount of them. Could you talk a little bit about the French relationship with water, l'eau?
Well, you know, France has water on several sides. And so the very first developed spas, supposedly, that did a certain kind of sort of aqua therapy were founded on the French coasts. And then, of course, since Renaissance times, Marguerite de Navarre talks about this in one of her texts, where people go and they gather around the spring waters that are supposed to rejuvenate. So there's this whole notion of health in water. And then there's the artistic notion of beauty in water, like in the Renaissance fountains. And if any of you listening ever go to Versailles during what they call les grandes eaux, so the big waters, that is in June every year on several weekends. And they turn on all of the magnificent fountains all over Versailles. And then there are light shows at night on all the waters. They don't leave them on all the time for ecological reasons, but it is a gorgeous thing if you happen to be there.
Oh, wow. That's a reason to go to France in the summer. So they also developed thalassotherapy. And it's fascinating that the French government feels this is so good for the health of their citizenry that they will pay usually a minimum of 70% for you to go to a thalassotherapy spa for 3 whole weeks and improve your health that way. And I loved your description of you experiencing your first thalassotherapy spa. So will you take our listeners through what going to a thalassotherapy spa could involve?
Right. So this is water therapy, and it can be found, the sites can be found either on the French coast, which is where I went. And by the way, I was not subventioned, as they say, or underwritten by the French government, but you can go and have some of these treatments just as interest or as you want to do it. So I wanted to find out what these treatments were like. And so I spent several days having, you know, water hoses aimed at me and kind of enveloped in algae and all sorts of wonderful things. But again, that was developed in the 19th century. And the idea is, I mean, it's almost, I didn't say this in the book, but it's almost baptismal. The idea is that you are somehow cleansed and you come out renewed. And it's really quite an interesting phenomenon. Something very funny is that a French friend of mine read my book after the fact and said, "But you say that thalassotherapy and the government supporting that is such an unusual thing. You treat it like it's really unusual." And I said, "It is unusual." And she said, "They don't do that in the U.S.
Yeah.
Because she assumed that all industrial countries paid for this for their citizens, but no.
Right. And your descriptions were hilarious. I mean, when you say getting shot with a hose, this sounded like a fire hose. At one point,
really
you go in for that treatment and the woman kind of grins at you when you say you've never done it before.
Oh, yes, it was quite an experience. But again, these are, you know, for people who have really big muscular problems or any host of health reasons that they think this rather dramatic treatment is going to help cure them.
Did you feel better after you did this?
Well, I just, in my case, I think I just had a lot of fun. and I had fun writing about it too, because it really was kind of an adventure.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So we go from thalassotherapy and cleansing yourself to perfuming yourself. I did not realize that. I don't think we can say that perfume was invented in France. We don't know that. But it became popular, or it was popularized by Catherine de' Medici, who was a French queen, although born in Italy. And tell a little bit about her. And also, I've always wanted to go to, and I hope I'm not going to pronounce this wrong, is it Grasse?
Yes, Grasse. Mm-hmm. Right.
Grasse, which is
near the Mediterranean coast. Yeah, where they still, many of the manufacturers anyway, still use nothing but natural perfumes from the plants that they grow right there, because it's kind of a microclimate, not quite on the coast, but very protected, so it never gets very, very hot. It's a gorgeous place. But I think perfumes, well, at least in the West, I mean, who knows, maybe Japan, China, these sorts of things were happening, just like the invention of the printing press by the Europeans in the 14th century when they had similar movable type in China for some time. But so I think we're really a little bit ignorant about a lot that went on in the East. But I do think that it became the best known probably in Italy, which Catherine de Médicis, which I say in the French way because the French claim her too, you know, which she brought to France. And she brought her perfumer, who was sometimes actually accused of murder because he would supposedly put very toxic perfume on gloves or something for people that Catherine wanted to get rid of. This is apocryphal, I think. Catherine de Médicis has been painted as, you know, the horrible femme fatale and so on. So I think a lot, but those stories are fun. But it is true that she did bring, she pretty much brought perfume to the French court.
Yeah. And when you go to Grasse, you say that because it has these fields upon fields of flowers, that the town itself is perfumed.
Yes.
This sounds magical.
Yes, it's natural. Another thing to do is to go to the Provence. A lot of the Provence fields with lavender in a different, slightly different part of France, but lavender fields, if you've had that privilege of being in a lavender field, that is sort of extraterrestrial wonderful.
Yes. And when you put on some nice perfume, you are well suited to be in close contact with people. And that is something else that the French do differently than we do. Friends will grab their arms and walk together with an arm around each other. Mm-hmm. When you meet, you kiss people on the cheek. And I've always been baffled by how many times I was supposed to kiss people. So can you, there's no formula, right? What?
Right, because it's different in different regions of France, first of all. And so even they joke because they'll say something like trois fois, you know, three times in certain regions of the South. One of my best friends in Paris was born in Paris, but her mother was from the South. So she always kissed three times. In some regions of France, it's four times. In Paris, it tends to be only twice. But of course, the trick is knowing which side to start on. And, you know, sometimes you have some head crashes because I learned it was right cheek to right cheek starting. But if you're close to somebody and you happen to have your left cheek up, then you might as well start with that side. But sometimes, you know, there are crashes when you think, oh, that's right, it's supposed to be the right side.
Do the French crash too? Because I always feel like it's just me.
Occasionally, but they're better at it because they've had a lot of experience practicing.
Right.
But poor little children, and this is a tradition that may be being lost a little bit, but they used to force children to say, oh, here are the guests. Go and greet the guests with a little kiss. And the poor kids have never seen this person in their lives, and they go over and they sort of kiss you on the cheek and because they're dutifully doing what their parents asked them to do. I think there's, a little less of that forced politesse or politeness.
Right. Interesting. So that may be going away. You start the book talking a lot about food, and food is such the French subject, I feel. I want to talk about some of the, not trivia, but facts I learned from your book, like the croissant. I had no idea that the croissant had both Islamic and Austrian background to it.
Right. Yes. The thing is, the little bread form as it came from Austria was not exactly the same with the multi wonderful buttered layers that we know today. But this story may be apocryphal, but the idea is that after an important battle of defeating the Ottomans, the Austrians made as a sort of celebratory cake almost, these little croissants shaped like the moon, like the Muslim moon, to show that they had won the battle. And supposedly that was then brought into France from Austria by Marie Antoinette. And there's actually a bakery from that period where the baba au rhum was brought to France also. And that's in the Marais on the Rue de Montorgueil, and it's the oldest bakery in Paris. You can go there and get the original baba au rhum and get croissant as well. So yes, that's the origin, but the way the croissants are very light and thin layered, that's entirely French.
Well, yes, definitely. So the French also are so, I don't want to say obsessed, but so involved in food that they have many, many sayings that involve food. I love the fact that you talked about Macron causing an international incident when he met another head of state and talked about his delicious wife.
Yes, exactly. Because in French, you can say something is délicieux because a lot of French vocabulary has to do with food, but it applies beyond food, right? And that is the secret. So yes, it made, I think, the headlines of several newspapers that Macron had given a compliment on your most delicious wife, right? Exactly.
Right. You also have a list, a delightful list of French terms that have to do with food, but have other meanings. I'm going to try and pronounce them, but avoir la pêche. What does that mean? And what does that mean?
So literally to have the peach, but to be, you know, peppy and to be well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. And raconteur de salade.
Yes, raconteur de salade, someone who tells salads. So someone who just makes things up and goes on and on about that. Yes, and goes on and on. A little bit of this, a little bit of that. Right. Like a salad.
Mettre de l'eau dans son vin.
Yes. So children traditionally could drink a little bit of wine at special occasions with water in it. So it was diluted. So mettre de l'eau dans son vin means putting some water in your wine, but it's diluting it. So if you're going to give somebody some bad news, you might put a little water in the wine as you're telling them this.
Fabulous. Mettre du beurre dans les espinards.
Yes. Mettre du beurre dans les épinards. Good. You're doing fine, by the way.
I studied French from kindergarten to fourth grade and then stupidly switched to Spanish.
But it's somewhere in the back of your mind.
It's in the back of my head. Yes.
Exactly. Mettre du beurre dans les épinards means to put butter in your spinach, put butter in the spinach. And that means to make a little more money or to dress it up.
Huh. Interesting. And the last one, c'est la fin des haricots.
C'est la fin des haricots. It's the end of the beans. So that means it's the end of the line. It's the end of the rope.
Yeah.
But again, isn't that interesting how we use rope and line and they use something edible?
Yeah. Fascinating. I love those sayings. And I love the fact you talked about the French employment code or work code saying that it is illegal in France to eat at your desk.
Right.
Why is that?
Well, it's in some ways, it's anybody's best guess. Some theories are that it would just keep the workplace tidier and not smelly and that sort of thing. But my hypothesis is that actually workers work better too. They take a break. And so they will go out for a petit café, or they will go to a little tiny bar or café, or even get a sandwich on the street, but eat it in the park as a way to have a kind of a breather. Again, it's a little bit like the thalassotherapy, you know, starting anew. And so I think it was made because it was good not only for the workers, but also the employers, that employees would kind of get a break, come back, work freshly after that.
Yeah, and it brings some joie de vivre into your life, as did reading this book.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Yeah, thank you so much for appearing on the Fromer Travel Show.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
And that is it for this week's show. I thank you so much for listening. And to those who are traveling, and I feel very French today, I'm going to say, may I wish you a hearty bon voyage.
Trying to remember all the songs we like to play. Luxury flights and hotels can be had for free. The world of points and miles sounds too good to be true, but it's actually real, but only if you know what you're doing.
On Frequent Miler on the Air, Greg and I, I'm Nick, discuss all the ways to earn points and miles and use them for outsized value.
Join us every Friday for our full episodes and every Tuesday for our quick, single-topic coffee break episodes.
See you there.